This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
We suspect there's actually no one out there on the road.
Well, the suspicion may be true, but good morning and selamat raya, maaf zebatin to everyone and anyone who's listening on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have an exciting lineup for you this morning. You know, regardless of whether there are people out on the road or not, we have on the breakfast grill this morning Professor Arfa Saleh, founding CEO of Putra Business School, formerly known as the Graduate School of Management at University Putra, Malaysia.
So this is when Melissa is speaking to Prof. Arfa Saleh, and this is part of her business school exploration. If you remember, Sharad, on Tuesday, Melissa spoke to Professor Ilyan Mihov of the School of the Dean of Business School of INSEAD. And if you remember, INSEAD was the school that created the, or published more likely, the Blue Ocean Strategy book. It was supposed to be the revolutionary thing. And even if you don't believe anything about that book, people use it as a verb and a noun collectively already. You know, it's like, I want to do a blue ocean thing. So anyway, that was the international front. The question today is, would the local business schools like Putra Business School have that edge in actually, you know, making a mark at the B school business?
Yeah, I think there's also this whole question of the increasing levels of or deepening of a culture of certification. We want certificates with apparently with everything, and you know, and people are getting more and more certificates. The question is, are those, or is the value of those certificates, you know, in fact being driven down by just the sheer volume of certificates being churned out at a variety of institutions for whom, you know, quality might not be assured. And so there is, you know, this paradox of increasing certification institutions, you know, sort of giving people the chop of you know, validation, but then at the same time, those validation might not actually mean anything.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this whole obsession about certifications and so on, you tend to forget, you know, the ongoings of how or what makes a person good at work or at school, right? I mean, if you think about it, we keep on referring to these, you know, so-called billionaires of the tech giants. You know, they dropped out of school, and they, you know, they tend to be slightly more remarkable because they're out of that mold. And you know,
but you know, this factor that you brought up is something that Melissa's almost instant response to this is that because they dropped out of, you know, some of the top schools, so they already got their foot in. It's not like, you know, they weren't in the running for something major, at least on scholastic terms. But you're absolutely right, you know, Ibrahim. I over the weekend at Raya, my only open house, I spoke to this young lady who works for a fintech company in the country. And she was, and I said to her, what did you study? And she said, well, you know, Sharad, I've only got an SPM. I said, oh, you only got an SPM? And she, and I said, well, maybe it was experience. And she said, when she joined this company, they didn't even look at her resume. They spoke to her, they set up some scenarios and said, how would you respond? And they were looking for, two things, right? Her analytical skills, figuring out the problem, and two, her ability to communicate what she would do. And because she's an extraordinary young woman, she's very articulate, and I think that's partly because of her family background. She, you know, she has commanded the language and such, and she's also had experience working in retail and such. And so that was what the company was looking for. And I think how extraordinary for companies that understand this, that that's what they should be looking for, rather than just the certificate that comes from, you know, any number of these little colleges that dot the country.
Now, having said that, we're not taking anything away from you know, the business schools in and out of Malaysia. And one of the two questions that we'll be asking would be whether or not MBAs are truly worth it, and whether or not there are right now a clear or growing trend on graduates opting for startups and to be entrepreneurs instead of getting MBAs. Because you know, it's not just about the tech startups. It's about running a business outright, brick and mortar, you know, opening a restaurant, that kind of stuff.
But what about the question of, you know, which business school you go to? Because clearly the business school you go to will determine the kind of networks you're going to be plugged into. And I'm sure people pay a premium for getting into, you know, one of those schools where your cohorts are already kind of like on the verge of something.
Yeah.
And then plus a history, an alumni, who you can tap into, which you can tap into, you know, who already have achieved things, you know. And so there's a kind of somewhat incestuous circle. But that's the circle that you want to tap into. So you pay good money to Wharton and stuff.
Absolutely. And I think it'll be very difficult for anyone to argue against that networking skills or networking ability for you to build upon if you enter these kind of schools, right? In fact, that is one of the primary reasons why I'm holding out on my my turn to go into a business school, because I feel that I might need a little bit more, you know, investment so that I can tap into this, you know, circle of friends.
I didn't know. So this is the back of your mind.
I mean, So I got my degree and I got my professional certification in chartered accountancy, you know, and hopefully I can finish my damn, you know, CFA. But
oops.
Yeah. But after all this, right, at the end of the day, you would want that networking, you know, ability, and I'm holding up for that.
Wonderful. You know, I think lifelong learning is a joy, and so, you know, and should be embraced. Now, moving on from the grill and our concerns about business school, today on the Property Show, we speak to Sheldon Fernandez, propertyguru.com.my. Now, we're going to be looking at the question of loan approvals and such. And, you know, Sheldon will be sharing methods and schemes now available to help finance the buying of real estate. Of course, the real estate market has been rather soft, hasn't it, Ibrahim?
Yeah.
Following, you know, the general downturn in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's all in the numbers, actually. We saw loan approval ratings from banks in Malaysia actually dipping. We saw loan disbursements from banks also dipping. And it's not just for residential property, but also commercial properties as well. And I think this is emblematic of the downturn of the economy of Malaysia. And I think because of the loan approvals at an all-time low, I think a lot of purchasers are right now putting off that purchasing because of the inability for them to get loans. So I think for us, having Sheldon Fernandez, the representative of propertyguru.com.my, he is able to actually perhaps shed methods and schemes that could actually help home buyers or property buyers to analyze what is the best way to maximize their ability to get loans from banks.
Well, you know, over the last couple of days, I've also been having meals with friends and family, and I was really surprised about the how deep the economy, you know, the slump in the economy is.
Yeah.
I have a young nephew who graduated over a year ago from, you know, a fairly well-known university, a foreign university based in Malaysia, with a degree in engineering, and he hasn't been able to land a job, partly because I think he, you know, is focused on getting a job in oil and gas, but still, you know, being employed in a field that he wasn't trained for over a year is quite extraordinary. And another nephew who, you know, was a scholar at one of our big GLCs, who talks about, though it's happening quietly, MSS, or, you know, mutual separation schemes that are now, you know, in full swing in some of these GLCs.
Yeah, and I think that kind of inability for them to land a job, particularly in these, you know, tried and tested industries in Malaysia, is going to be problematic going forward. But yes.
Can you imagine the investments their parents have made and the hopes and aspirations that they have? I mean, a couple of years ago when they had to make this decision, oil and gas was, you know,
the height of everything.
And, you know, the assumption would be that it would be able to come out and they would reap the benefits of an industry that, you know, was paying its people well. And so I think both the question of the return on the investment, but also the deep disappointment or the need to defer those aspirations until the economy picks up.
You know, at the end of the day, I think it's in the inability for people to be very nimble of what they study. Essentially, you can take what you study in one field and try to apply it in another. It's always, you know, if you have that practical approach, you can actually intertwine one over the other. For instance, if you study law, trust me, everything in life is about law. If you study corporate law, you can quickly change it to, you know, business law, corporate, you know, taxation law, and so on. In accounting, it's the same thing. Technical skills like engineering also. So I guess, you know, perhaps, you know, try to be nimble as possible, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good thing. You know, you learn to, you know, to be resilient, right? Now, speaking of resilience, Taiwan and China facing bad weather. We have on the news, Taiwan is bracing itself for the arrival of a, and I quote here, a vast typhoon.
Yeah, so large is this typhoon that many of the airlines, including Malaysia Airlines and Air Asia, is diverting their flights to navigate around this typhoon. It's going to be a huge typhoon that is going to hit Taiwan.
Yeah, it's called a Category 5 typhoon, Nepartak. A lot of Category 5 typhoons that are kind of identified out at sea, when in fact they hit land,
they will decrease.
But sometimes they don't, and that's an issue. For us who don't suffer typhoons, maybe giving a bit of detail about this. It's a super typhoon and winds of over 260 kilometers per hour, and that's expected to hit Taiwan tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now, China has been suffering from flooding, and one of the worst cities hit, or one of the biggest cities of China that's been hit, is Wuhan. Apparently, transport links and water and power supplies to the city of 10 million severely affected. And you'll see this this flooding is supplying the global media with a lot of stunning images.
Yeah, and these stunning images is basically caused by, you know, these massive, you know, storms. But my question to you is, Sharad, do you know if there is any difference between a typhoon, a cyclone, and a hurricane?
Well, I know a cyclone is a kind of twister, so that's a different.
Yeah.
That's a different.
Actually, they're all the same thing.
Are they a cyclone and the same?
They're all the same.
I thought
thing.
A cyclone was one of those twisters that you see coming and where's
they all have this massive storm with an eye in the middle. Except that the terminology that is used is depending on which location that you're using it at. For instance, hurricane is being used in the Atlantic and some of the areas in the Pacific. Typhoons normally used in the Northwest Pacific, so that means Japan and Taiwan and so on. And cyclone is everywhere else. So yes, there you go. Factoid of Friday morning. Hashtag did you know moment.
Okay, some factoids coming from the floods in China. China's floods in numbers. This came from the BBC World Service. 32 million people in 26 provinces across China have been affected by severe flooding. Some 180 people more have died, while 45 are missing. 1.5 million people have been relocated, and 56,000 homes have collapsed.
You know, this is extremely, you know, 1.5 million being relocated. I just cannot imagine the kind of numbers.
Well, that's China too, right, in terms of the scale.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you've seen this on the media, the football stadium that's filling up with rainwater. Have you seen that? Yeah,
no,
that's quite dramatic.
Yeah, okay.
Also equally dramatic developments in Bangladesh, yet another attack, this time on the largest Eid gathering by militants, throwing homemade bombs and launching a gun attack. Police say four people were killed, including two officers and one attacker.
So this comes right after that execution style 20 people
at a
cafe, or sorry, bakery of sort in Dhaka.
Dhaka, right?
Yeah, and this is different from that, right?
Yeah, this is different. And this was, so apparently in the town of Kishoganj, I was looking at the map earlier, it's quite a distance from Dhaka. Some 300,000 people gather for Eid prayers, and this gathering was attacked at the security checkpoint. It's also interesting that clerics in Bangladesh have declared that people who kill in the name of Islam will not go to heaven; they go straight to hell. And this was actually quoted. This is one of the clerics saying this, and I believe he was also involved in the prayers. So maybe an attack on him as well.
You know, at the end of the day, right now there's a change of tact with these militants and terrorists. I think they're trying to target Islamic countries, to try and target Muslim population, and more damning, they're attacking Muslim holy sites like the Medina Mosque. And I start to question myself, what is their motive? What is it that is their end game? Is striking fear among fellow brother Muslims, amount to anything? And one thing is for sure, the world is topsy-turvy, because I really can't answer all these questions.
We'll be right back with more BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and you just heard Make Me Smile by Steve Harley.
Yeah.
I've had requests from friends saying, can't you play Justin Timberlake? And I'm not quite sure if Justin Timberlake is on our playlist. Is it, Chong'an, who's looking at the panel? Can you look quickly? Can we have a Justin Timberlake song to give? No? Oh, okay.
Such
no
a
Justin.
Sad, yeah.
Okay, I'm Sharad Kutin, and you're listening also to Ibrahim Sunny here with you this morning, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning on The Morning Run. Now, before we went for the break, we talked about...
I'm still wondering if anyone would be listening to... Sorry to interrupt you there, but...
But for the people who are listening, we were talking about violence during Eid, and you were saying that you were surprised by the violence. But, in some countries, sectarian violence has of the sort, targeting people at worship and places of holy places has been going on for decades, right? You think of Pakistan, right? Attacks on the Shiite minority community, or you think of war-torn zones like Iraq, where you've had many instances, during special religious occasions, those processions or holy places will be attacked.
Like, I'm not just talking about say the Eid, the two Eids, right? The Eid al-Fitri as well as Eid al-Adha, but perhaps even Ashura, a religious day in the Shia culture. And you're right, this whole targeting of basically mass congregation, anyone who just wants to congregate, mass.
Because it poses all kinds of security issues, right?
Yeah.
For the security forces, trying to filter out and identify possible militants or threats, and this is why at any point in time, when you have National Day celebrations or you have New Year's Eve celebrations, it's going to prove a huge headache for security forces trying to keep up the peace.
So, for one reason or another, I became a fanboy of Leonardo DiCaprio over the past 2 days. I watched three movies of his over the span of 2 days. And the latest movie that I watched was Blood Diamond, which was about 6 hours ago. I watched it again, perhaps my upteenth time. And one line caught my attention in that he says that since when was the world not on fire? And he's referring to the, at least in the movie, the Sierra Leone conflict.
Yeah.
But there is some truth in that, if you think
about it. Of course, I think.
Yeah, the world is always in conflict.
Maybe peace is the anomaly. Do you like the film because of that father-son relationship that's very strong in the film?
Yeah, it reminded me of my relationship with my ex-girlfriend.
Which is not a father-son relationship.
Ma'af Zahe Batin, but seriously, she's in a constant crisis of conflict all the time. And I think... that movie is emblematic of her.
So maybe she should be watching it. Okay, moving on very quickly. I think, we're in this season, we're also looking at the very serious question of the roots of violence, of sectarian violence or religiously inspired violence. And following the massacre in Dhaka at that bakery, all eyes have turned on the preacher Zakir Naik, who courted controversy when he came here the last time. And we've had politicians in Malaysia jumping to his defense, saying that it's premature to prejudge the situation because one of the attackers followed Zakir Naik's sermons doesn't mean that Zakir Naik is responsible. And I think that's valid enough. But what has been quite perhaps heartening is to know that in Malaysia, instead of just defending and sort of dismissing concerns, they're actually going to do some investigations. We don't know about the quality of the investigations, but the IGP says that he will actually have a look at what was being said or has been said by this particular preacher over time.
This is in contrast to the religious or deputy religious minister, more appropriately deemed as the deputy minister in the Prime Minister's Department in charge of religious affairs, Dr. Ashraf Wajdi. He was ambushed, actually, by press men on the morning of Raya, and basically the journalists were asking him what was his view on Zakir Naik, particularly when Zakir Naik has been mentioning all these, what they deem as inflammatory, you know, kind of sermon. And Ashraf Wajdi says that, is it even true that these sermons were being said? And of course, journalists there was a bit shocked because, you know, the evidence is there on YouTube. Anyone can Google.
Yeah, and also that he had already been, had courted controversy in several countries that had banned him. Yes, it's good not to prejudge things. But I wonder, you know, Ibrahim, if that too many politicians in the country have been tied up with Zakir Naik. If you remember, he, you know, was received like a prince. You know, we had offers of, you know, islands made by the Mantri Basata.
Literally, yeah.
Yeah, literally. And everybody was lining up to, you know, kiss the hem of his cassock, you know, yeah. And it was very interesting, or rather his double-breasted suit or whatever that he likes to wear.
Yes, okay.
But, you know, a lot of politicians, I think, lined up. And so maybe now that his name has been dragged into this controversy, they're a bit loath to into dump him or to be say anything negative because it also reflect on them, right?
Yeah, so and the choices they make to back this person in the first place.
Yeah, also, I mean, in the news, very interesting, an inquiry by the British government on the Iraq War some years ago now, led by Sir John Chilcot. Very interesting because it's put Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister, in a very negative light. In fact, so negative that he now faces compensation claims from families of British soldiers killed in the war.
Yep.
This is huge, right? Because it's finally...
So huge that it trended on Twitter UK for 2 days, but yes.
Yes, and if you look at some of the responses coming out of the Middle East, and I'm just going to quote some. Here's Egyptian newspaper Al Watan says, after 13 years, Britain admits the crime of destroying Iraq. Another one, this is the Bahraini newspaper, Akbar Al-Khalij, says.
Good try, yeah.
No, thank you very
Al-Khalij,
much.
Al-Khalij, yes.
I should be doing something, right? I'll clear my throat. Yeah, okay.
Go on.
Shameful, Blair is a war criminal. Chilcot report exposes and condemns Blair for invading Iraq.
Yeah, and our regular commentator, one of them, even retweeted something that Dr. Mahathir said in 2007, where Dr. Mahathir says that Tony Blair should be remembered as a child murderer and a person that did not exhaust all peace
options
first. And it's so interesting that 9 years ago, Dr. Mahathir said this. I'm not a fanboy of Dr. Mahathir. I'm a more of a, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio kind of guy. But as you can see, Mahathir says the same thing Sir John Chilcot said, you know, 2 weeks ago, yeah. What Mahathir said 9 years ago.
Yeah. So the process, and I think even the Padana Leadership Foundation tried to sponsor a kind of people's tribunal on the responsibility of people like, not John Major, Tony Blair.
John Major doing a bit, but yeah.
The Oman's newspaper, I'll quote this, it's a very interesting quote from Oman's pro-government newspaper, Al Watan. The West has a consistent urge to see the Arab world stumbling. Could we forget Sykes-Picot, Balfour Declaration, the establishment of Israel, and the continuous attacks on Arabs since the Crusades? All this, always search for Britain. Very interesting because it also gives you a sense of the feeling of victimhood that's very deep also in the Middle East with regard to imperial powers, right? And Britain, of course, leading the charge in that regard, carving up the Middle East dividing it.
My question now is, how does this reflect on the leadership of the UK? How does this play into how the Conservative Party leadership race is going to play out, particularly when, you know, the Conservatives were one of the heavy what do you call this critique of Tony Blair when he wanted to go to war because he was a Labour Party government then.
Yeah, but you know, it was a party, Labour Party, that was so aligned to its, you know, or so wedded to its transatlantic relationship, like Tony Blair and George W. Bush. You know, really kind of in a love fest over the bodies of so many.
They still are in that love fest, well, by the way.
Okay, we're going to come up to the news very soon with Audrey Raj. After that, more news and analysis. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run. That was Selamat Hari Raya Bonda by Dato Sri Siti Nurhaliza.
You know.
Or should I say Nurhaliza?
No. Siti Nurhaliza has always been, you know, one of those Malay artists that I kind of admire.
She's an icon. I mean, she's major. I mean, could you think of her, you know, her rise? You know, as a young woman, she's done so well for herself. She's diversified, you know, in all kinds of areas beyond her talent base.
And she's and she did good, you know. And trust me when I say this, she can sing live. I've seen her sing live twice, and it was really kind of good.
Yeah, well, I bet she can sing live. You know, she's got an amazing voice.
You know, this whole singing live, we take things for granted for some of the newer artists.
Okay,
out
they're people who are made in recording studios rather and post-production rather than actually mm-hmm. based on that raw talent. That's true. That's very true. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Ibrahim Sunny, and we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. We'll have the Breakfast Grill after 8 a.m. And we'll also have the property show today at about 9:30. So it's now 6:40 in the morning. Just coming back to some of the news that we were talking about, Hiswani has tweeted in with, you know, links to stories on that issue we talked about, the Iraq war, mm-hmm. the decision made by the British government to go to war, then under the Labour government helmed by Tony Blair, and Tony Blair now at the centre of that inquiry into the actions of the British government at that point and how responsible it was. This inquiry now opens him up to compensation claims, you know, beyond the simple matter of apologies, because people lost their lives. I mean, not only the British soldiers who will be able to make those claims, but because, you know, huge numbers of Iraqis who've had to suffer at the hands of, you know, this neoconservative or neocon agenda in the Middle East, as far as I can tell, what really animated the fight against Saddam Hussein. After all, you know, they were great friends with Saddam Hussein until they stopped being friends.
Yeah.
So Hiswani, I mean, I think this discussion, he says that Charles Kennedy with the Lib Dems is now vindicated, as is Tun Mahathir, in opposing the war. Apparently, the Lib Dems were the only party in Britain that unanimously voted against the war. And so this was 2003. All 53 MPs said no.
But, you know, the Lib Dems are nowhere to be seen in this anarchy of the UK right now, because they were not pretty popular any longer than and now even.
Well, because they got into a coalition with
which is an extremely unpopular kind of decision to be made.
Okay, yeah. So anarchy in the UK, the front page headline of the Economist.
Yeah.
And of course we also have stories in the news about the leadership struggle. Interesting, the men who led the Leave campaign have both, one dropped out and one has failed.
And the third guy that actually backed, you know, Boris Johnson, he has been eliminated from the leadership as well.
Yeah. So in the leadership competition, two women remain, and that's Theresa May and Andrea Leadsom.
Yeah. So this will, the headline of this is that UK will get their second female prime minister after Margaret Thatcher. And I don't know whether you saw this. There was a senior Tory MP who was caught on camera saying all the negative things about these candidates, right? About Theresa May, about Michael Gove, and so on. And it wasn't meant to be published, but it was aired anyway by Sky. So you can imagine the ethical capacity of that organization. But he said, one interesting thing is that he said that, you know, Theresa May is an extremely difficult person to work with, but you and I, as in he, the person that he speaks about and speaks to, you and I, we worked with Margaret Thatcher, so I guess we should know what's coming at us.
All right.
So, you know, tongue-in-cheek kind of notion, but Theresa May does have that Iron Lady kind of approach, the same way that Margaret Thatcher is very well known of.
Okay, so you know, this wrangling within the Conservative Party, of course, is going to have a direct and material effect on who becomes the next Prime Minister of Britain.
Yeah.
But
of course, don't hold your breath, because the winning candidate will be decided in early September. So Andrew Leadsom as well as Theresa May will perhaps position themselves quite critically on how they want to execute the Brexit, because right now that's the only thing that is concerning the Tories predominantly.
Okay, so what we have now, because it's political wrangling, It's, you know, it's quite bloody. There's a lot of, you know, backstabbing, because all of this is figurative rather than literal. It's in some sense, you know, the way in which democratic politics takes, harnesses all these energies in society and puts them through a kind of civilizing channel. But but anarchy and carnage loom, as we were talking, loom large in the life of human beings. We were just talking about the attempt at another massacre in Bangladesh only yesterday. Also, a story that's in the news, quite sad story of a couple that escaped the Boko Haram militants in Nigeria. This couple had had their families that were killed in attacks on churches in Nigeria. They went to Italy, found a new life, got married, and the churches in Italy were very supportive of them. One of them has since been killed in what the Italian government calls a racist attack. And the killer was described in news reports as a football fan. Now, I don't know how why football was implicated in this, but at any rate, this is how the BBC reports it. Interesting that the Italian government is very concerned to describe this as a racist attack, and it's charging the man, you know, for that. But what I think it's really tragic in reading the story, Ibrahim, is the fact that they suffered so much trying to find a new life. You know, they escaped Nigeria, they lost their child, and because they had you know, no papers with them, you know, they were remarried in church in Italy. Apparently, Italian churches have been attacked as well by these racists. So they've been the subject of small bomb attacks by racists in Italy, because of their work with immigrants. So kind of all around just the meanness of human beings. Moving on, we have a story we think is kind of interesting, because it reflects on monuments dedicated to politicians. And of course, one of the big monuments, and I saw it recently in an episode of House of Cards, which was Mount Rushmore. And Mount Rushmore, of course, is that monument with the faces of four American notables. I think they're all presidents.
They're all presidents.
Carved onto the side of a mountain. Can you imagine a mountain in Malaysia carved out? Who would be the candidate for having their face?
Perhaps the president of MIC, Batu Caves, but yes. The Mount Rushmore Memorial.
The current one or the former?
The four presidents that we speak of includes George Washington, the first president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, the second president of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, as well as Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States.
So I wonder how, having had so many presidents, I don't know when...
44 in total, actually,
So when Mount Rushmore was actually chiseled, and so when that decision was made, why choose these four,
right? Because if you think about it, it was finished in 1941. At that time, they already had about close to 40 presidents already. So this is the interesting part. The sculptor basically says that we got to have at least two of the founding fathers there. So they decided on, you know, let's choose the first two since we need, you know, two. And the remaining two, Theodore Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln, so this is a bit legend, of course, is that the sculptor chose the two easier chiseled faces of the United States president.
Oh, really? I mean, Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah, it's his longitudinal face.
I see. But what is also interesting about the story, I'm going to tweet this out, is that the man who oversaw the creation of the Mount Rushmore monument was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, a deeply racist white supremacist organization.
If not militant.
Militant, because they killed black people. They, you know, hung them from trees. They burned them. You know, like a lot of countries where, you know, you have this majoritarian culture, the people who perpetrated these crimes rarely ever had to pay for their crimes, right? So it's quite an interesting look at the development of this thing. I wonder if many people even know much about this history. I mean, because it's not our history, but to the extent that, you know, American culture sort of is global in its reach, will, you know, this image, like Times Square, will be familiar to a lot of Malaysians, I think. But there are in Malaysia monuments to our former prime minister. There's one. It stands somewhat lonely in Putrajaya. I think people don't know it.
I don't know
it. But it's a steel structure, commemorating the so-called fathers of the nation. And it actually is the former prime ministers.
Yeah, and I think there is a reason for this, because culturally Malays frown upon sculptures, because they see this as berhala or something that
kind of worshipping.
Yeah, kind of worshipping. So it does go against the Malay culture and Malay norms, not necessarily Islamic norms, but I can understand why we don't have that many sculptors around the country.
Oh, right. Okay. So, but if you had to, if you had to create a monument, what would you?
P. Ramlee, hands down.
P. Ramlee. Well, why P. Ramlee?
I mean, I still watch his movies. I mean, kind of like, immortalizes the whole notion of a timeless classic.
Yeah, and at time, Malaysians didn't take themselves so seriously, weren't easily offended, were fun-loving and inclusive, and dressed in a very sexy and outgoing fashion, right? I mean, the tragic end of P. Ramlee, I think, is a story that's been told over and over again.
Yeah, like Elvis Presley and any other of these guys.
Yeah,
right?
But here also, kind of a lack of... So while he's celebrated... Often, I think, in real life, he was, in fact, marginalized. But, okay, we're going to tweet out that link to the story on Mount Rushmore. Think about, your own Mount Rushmore, the Mount Rushmore in your heart.
Oh, cool.
And we're going to... While we contemplate that...
Happy Friday, Shirat.
We're going to go... the news is coming up at 7, and you're going to have some music before that. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.